Hi, this is Ed Long at Information Farm. Joining us today for a discussion of Walter Bort are Bob Dobbs and James Martinez. And later on, Ion will be joining us to give us a perspective from the non-physical, and Ion's going to bring in a mystery guest from the non-physical. So, Bob and James, welcome.
Hello, Ed.
Thanks so much. Thanks.
Well, James, I wanted to ask you, since Bob's interview last week, what sort of response have you got to his interview?
You know, I just finished listening to it yesterday. I listened to it in two parts, and it was great for me to hear that, actually, because I knew in the final stage, in the final, you know, the final act of his life, so to speak, and all the previous parts that he did that were that kind of made his name and how he got developed and how he developed his person and so forth and where he went and what he did, he filled in a lot of those gaps. And one of the things that I don't recall him telling me personally, that when Walter and Bob met, it was the last time the McLuhan Center was going to be open, doing the things it was doing previously in its format and its presentation of itself. And when he arrived, it ended. And that, to me, was quite significant. I didn't know that before. And how so that relationship started and, you know, kind of caused a right angle. Because I don't believe he got to meet McLuhan, and that's what the point is, but he got to meet his second-in-command, so to speak, Bob, and that showed me how influential Bob was to his life. So the other things in there historically, which he was involved with and so forth, I was aware of, but some of the tidbits regarding that and one of his wives was new to me, but I thought it was a good piece of information because he was there, and if I were to be talking about things that went back that far, it would be merely reference based upon you know, his final stages in his life, which were very, 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 very different previously to the personality he was when he began, you know, East Village Other and Operation Mind Control and so forth. So it was a good interview. I thought it was well done, well done.
Yeah, James, I'd just say that I wasn't second in command at the McLuhan Center. Eric McLuhan was McLuhan's son. And as I point out in the interview, Walter did want to meet. He imagined that McLuhan had a son. He did want to meet him in 68, and he met him in 79. And so he got to interact with Eric.
Let me say what I meant by that. In terms of influence, you were second in command next to McLuhan. That's what I mean. That's what I meant.
Yeah, because of my knowledge of McLuhan, Walter was interested in that.
Right.
That's what you mean. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah, yeah, I wanted to add to. Beg your pardon?
In terms of influence, you were the second man.
Right. The I was thinking about this before starting the interview, that Walter Bort was the best looking guy of all those famous counterculture people, Abbie Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, and whoever else, Tim Leary. I was thinking about how handsome Walter was. I met him in 1979, 20 years before James did, and he was about 40 then, and he was really an amazing, charismatic-looking guy. And so I was thinking about, you know, he was probably more beautiful in the 60s, and that is probably why Peggy married him. You know, he had that, because Peggy knew a lot of the counterculture people through Tim Leary. And I can see that Walter would attract someone like Peggy. He could do that. And then I think of the Avant-Garde magazine. That magazine came out in 67, 68, in the article on Walter. You see Walter doing a one picture of him naked doing yoga with his wife, or it was a bit confusing, or a girlfriend after his wife. It says she was a school teacher. I don't know if it was Linda. Anyways, the other picture of Walter, he's in the East Village Other office looking down, and he has a big hat on, and you can't see his face. It's interesting. Walter had this whole charismatic image. He knew he was good-looking, yet he hid it. You know what I mean? He did not want media charisma or to exploit that. That's an interesting factor. Does that ring a bell with you, James?
No, but it's ironical, though, because when I met him, you wouldn't have thought that was remotely in his universe that he was a great-looking guy at all, because of his health was just awful. From the moment I met him, it was very bad. So, which means, you know, he didn't take care of himself like somebody that would have that type or have any vanity. He didn't really have that thing going on, which a lot of people do that are, you know, celebrities in their chosen field or whatever.
Right. Well, do you think? To me, he was still handsome when you met him in the late 90s. Didn't he strike you as reasonably handsome, good-looking?
No, because he was ill. I knew he was ill.
Oh, okay, because when I saw him in 99, and then the next time I saw him was 2005, I think, not so much in 2005, he was older and white, his hair was going white, but he seemed handsome, always seemed handsome, but he was very handsome in 79, in my experience, and tall, very charismatic, you know, well-built, and I when I met him, I said, man, this guy is the guy behind the counterculture. He had it going. And there is a book, it's maybe that book about acid, the famous book, The History of Acid, I'm not sure, or The History of the Counterculture Press, and Walter said there's someone described as Michael Bowen, B-O-W-E-N, who was important in the San Francisco 60s scene. Walter told me that that was him. And the guy, I guess Walter didn't want himself described in the book, because it was like Walter is still on duty. You know, even though the book is written in the 80s, say, he's still on duty and he's still making sure that he's not known, so to speak, or he's not allowing himself to have an image created. So I understood that this guy wrote all about Bowert knowing he couldn't use Walter's name, so he called him Michael Bowen. And I never found out whether there was a Michael Bowen and how much that's confused. But that's an interesting point, that he was a legend within this guy's history, but he couldn't use Walter's real name. Or the guy didn't know it was Walter and just heard all these stories about a Michael Bowen and put it in the book and didn't know it was about Walter. Maybe when we talk to Ion, we can get some of this cleared up.
Right.
Okay, so I just want to point out that I was thinking that he was the best-looking guy of all those, you know, media figures, counterculture figures, and he consciously, to me, didn't worry about that. He was just into truth, and as much as he could find it. So he seemed to be conscious of the media and kept his image low, because when I met him in 79, I was struck in retrospect at how you didn't see that in the magazine article. He didn't want people to see what he looked like.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that's, you don't think of Walter that way. You just think of him as being ill.
Never any emphasis on that at all, really.
Oh, no, yeah, and he wasn't trying to be, you know, to be good looking. And when I saw him in 79 in Toronto, when I first met him, he was in a really good suit, you know, and he was on this speech tour with, sponsored by Scientology. But I also was thinking about how great a speaker he was. He was a very good speech, great slides, and showed a lot of stuff. I mean, he really had a good mind. And he had a good mind, and he looked great. So I think it's great to talk about him if he's not known. I mean, he's known for Operation Mind Control, but this whole other history before, it's pretty interesting. What he had done, and it explains how he could meet people. He could make contacts with anybody. He was impressive as a person, so all kinds of people would want to tell him stuff. So maybe, James, did he ever tell you about the 40-day acid trip?
Constantly.
Right, constantly talking about it.
We were invited to a dinner party in Bel Air, California, here, and there was a very influential heiress there from Italy, and there was one of Bill Clinton's secretaries was at this dinner party. And for as long as I'd known him, I would always be joking with him, saying, you know, I'm going to have to get you that T-shirt so you don't have to keep asking everybody all the time. Did I tell you about my 40-day acid trip? Because he constantly, that would be a part of his initial conversation with people. As soon as he'd get rapport, he'd go straight into that. And I remember having, I was at this dinner party with him, and he asked Bill Clinton's secretary and good friend, did I ever tell you about my 40-day acid trip? And I was like, wow, this guy, he has no problem talking to whomever, whatever, about the subject matter, because it was a very, very influential thinking pattern that was installed when he had that experience. And it was constantly brought up in conversation sooner or later at some point with everybody.
If he was getting into a serious conversation with him and they were going to talk for a while and the person he could see was going to get to know Walter, he'd begin with that.
Yeah, well, he would want to elicit a response to determine where they were at in their consciousness by the mere suggestion of, is he serious? Is it a joke? Or where are they at? How will the person respond to something like that?
Yeah, I saw that a couple of times. I probably wasn't in as many social situations with Walter as you were. It was always just me and Walter and Carolyn, or whoever the wife was at the time, his partner. So, yeah, that's interesting. I can't think of too many places other than when I was there and other people being there that he would bring that. I didn't experience that, but it was always a reference point in our conversations. Like, it was almost like he wanted to find out more. Could you tell me more about what was happening if I tell you this, you know? Do you know something?
Right.
And that was another point. Did he ever tell you about how he found out who the guy was that did it to him? Did he ever give you those details?
Yeah, he gave me all details about all of that stuff as much as, and he repeated over and over, and it, to me it was like background noise because it was mixed up with so much other stuff, and I wasn't taking notes or anything because I figured that this was, a lot of it was public knowledge, but I was learning that he was telling me confidential things, so he kind of went into the scenario of how that happened, but it was weird when he started talking about it because he almost was thankful for the experience, even though initially he thought that drug, that whatever he was given, was a hostile thing. So it was kind of weird. One minute he'd think it was like they're trying to kill me, somebody's trying to kill me because of what I'm doing. And then on the other side of it, he'd go, well, it was one of the best things that ever happened to him. So it was a very strange thing. I have to listen closely in terms of the context in which he would start talking about it, because it would depend on his mood and a bunch of other things, in terms of how he would talk about it. But I don't recall exactly the name, but I remember him going into all these details and names of exactly what happened. And, I mean, really wringing out the laundry, so to speak. He wasn't afraid to tell me any of the who's who and whatever. And I didn't want to start taking notes or recording it because I thought he might stop immediately if that were to happen. So I got a lot of details of stuff, and it was kind of done kind of for his own, to flush out a lot of anger and rage and disgust and disappointment. And he was flushing out a lot, which was because he was toxic physically. And he was really diseased, not at ease completely. So he'd flush out a lot, including stuff about that you just asked right there.
Yeah, so I only remember him telling me once about the follow-up and how he found the guy, the scientist or the CIA guy, who gave him this drug, but you remember hearing details. So if someone you could generally tell the story, if pressed.
Yeah.
May not have the exact names because you know it better than me. Can you tell us a bit about what he said happened, how he discovered?
Well, I don't know the details to the point at which the setup, who set it up and why it was set up, but I can tell you, go into the details about when initially happened. He kind of went through, all I can describe it is like the an intense shamanic experience, because he was going to go through the death experience literally. Either he knew he was going to be killed, or that this drug or whatever it was, he said it was, he called it the God particle. It's something, he referred to with different names, but he would said that when he was given that stuff, he mentioned to me that if it were given in mass, it would end war forever. I mean, he went into the story about how he saw his colleagues, the other people that were drugged, died, or one of them died, and one of them ended up in a mental institution.
Now, are you saying he saw that those fates would happen to these people?
Mm-hmm.
He saw their future? Is that what you're saying?
No. He was alive. One of them died while he was alive, and the other one ended up in a mental institution. And so he thought, you know, he thought he might be close to his demise as well, and it didn't turn out that way.
Okay, wait. We're talking about the drug experience. What have the fates of these other people, what has that got to do with the drug experience?
Well, because when, according to him, he felt like he was supposed to be here even more, because he didn't die.
Okay. When did these guys die, James? When did they get in the mental hospital, and when they died? The other one died.
Post East Village Other.
Okay, that's after he took the drug. So why is he talking about these other guys? What's that got to do with the drug trip?
Because he indicated to me that what he thought was these other two guys that are associated with him were going to be killed. And he felt intuitively that they were going to get taken out, and he thought he was going to get taken out because of what he was doing with the newspaper. And
you're talking about, you're saying he felt that. Look, on the drug experience, during the drug, he looked at those two guys and he saw their fates. Is that what you're saying?
No, yeah, he did. He did see them, and that actually did happen. And on the drug experience, he would, as soon as he was talking about that 40 days, he would alter states right in the room talking about it, especially with me. So I saw him go into all these other levels of information, and I was like, at some point when I was initially talking to him when he first brought this out to me, I was like, wow, this guy's really lost it. There's something really wrong here. Literally change states into the same thing as a shaman would do when they're conducting an ayahuasca circle or something like that. He changed states entirely. Almost a different person was there.
Okay, but were you familiar with shamans changing their states at that point?
No.
So you were naive. You were naive about what was happening. So in your naive state, you thought, oh, this guy is nuts.
Right. That's right.
I see. And you're saying that when he went into this state and started talking about his life, he said, I saw the fates of a couple of people around me when I was on this drug, and those fates happened to them later.
Yep, that's right.
So that was the power of the drug trip. He felt he saw a bit of the future, in more than just those guys, many levels.
He made extraterrestrial contact. He did laying of the hands. He walked around. He told me about people that witnessed him bilocating and trilocating from different positions. So he was going through portals. Now, at that time when he was telling me all this, I'm like, wow, I had no reference point to even relate to this. And I never wrote it down because I thought, you know, he may get offended and not stop telling me what was happening. So I just listened most of the time, and I was completely confused. I understood it later on, and as I got to know him, but initially I thought, wow, there's something, they really screwed with his head. Oh. I'm like, whatever.
you started to feel sorry. And when you felt that, were you respectful and admiring Walter when you first met him?
Well, I admired him no matter what, because I heard what he had done initially when I was introduced to him in Tucson when I first met him. So
yeah, you'd be impressed with him, and then you found out, gee, everybody's impressed with this guy, but the guy's a nut. That's what you're talking about.
That's right. That's right. That happened quite a bit, actually. And then
he'd become nuttier. In different periods of more telling you stuff, he would become nuttier in your view.
Right. And then I found out that he wasn't nuts at all.
Yeah. Yeah, now...
It's my ignorance, mostly.
Right. But what I'm getting at is I recall he figured out who gave him the drug and confronted the guy or found out more about the drug. And I recall him saying that it was a new experimental drug, something new, and Walter was, they were watching him on this. Did that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Did he?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
But we don't know what the drug was.
No, he didn't know what it was. He said he wished he could find out what it was, and I just know it was in a liquid form like acid.
Yeah, a side thing, Ed, is what's interesting to me that, and this I always brought in this point when Walter first started telling me this stuff, and it's true, James is right, he always came back to that. That was his beginning point of his whole knowledge structure. You know what I mean? That everything, he would, whatever he learned when he wrote Operation Mind Control would be filtered through trying to understand what happened in late 66. And what struck me as interesting, I'd say, well, Walter, you were part of this point where Rai returned to the plane of essence in January 1967. I related to that based on what Worcester said, Dave Worcester said. You know what I mean, Ed, that Rai thing?
Yes. And you know, talking to Walter in the pre-Worcester interview, he said that the person who gave him that substance got it from George Hunter White. You know who George Hunter White is?
Yeah, he's the guy who says, I loved working for the CIA, I got to kill people, blah, 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 and do all this stuff, right?
That's right.
He's the one who made that famous quote.
And BZ is one of the substances he worked with, which is 10 to 100 times more potent than LSD, and usually lasts about 4 days. But there was another secret drug they were using, was called JB118. And these substances were used to incapacitate enemy agents. But the result was, you know, like acid, it depended on your state of mind. So one person might be incapacitated, and Walter might be having these experiences like you're talking about, where he's buying and tri-locating and seeing ETs and so on.
When did this information come out about those two drugs you named?
That's been out for quite a while. It's in the book Acid Dreams. It's on the internet.
Acid Dreams, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so yeah, Acid Dreams, I don't think is the book that I was trying to remember that talks about Michael Bowen. It might be. If you have Acid Dreams there and you got a second while we're talking, might see if there's a Michael Bowen in the index. Do you have the book there?
Oh, I don't have it with me now, but Michael Bowen, I accessed that. It's on the internet. And it is funny because when I was reading that, I said, this sounds just like Walter. I don't understand. The timelines were the same and what he was doing were the same as Walter Bowen.
Yeah, interesting. So that's what I'm talking about. So I could read that part. People can, what could they put in? Michael Bowen and Walter Bowen? What do they, to Google it, how do they read that part, find it?
I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to research it and get back with you. But the way but I they, found it, I was looking for Walter Bowen interviews, and it came up.
When were you doing this? When were you interested in Walter Bowen?
Oh, I was doing just research for this interview yesterday.
Oh, you just discovered this the other day.
Yes.
The Michael Bowen thing. So it's out there, you're saying. And you thought, yeah, that's what Walter said. It was based on him. But I was confused about how much the author had interacted with Bowen. Did you ever hear him talk about this, James?
No.
So for the record, people, when you read Acid Dreams, the Michael Bowen character may be about Walter Bowen. and Bowert may have not wanted him. I sort of remember him not wanting to have this history put on him. He wanted to be anonymous. Does that evoke anything for you, James, about him talking on that level?
No, I told him that he was passing the baton to me, so he said, "You do whatever you want."
Yeah, but did he tell you that he did not? Did you get a sense that he didn't want a high media profile?
No, not at the end. He didn't care.
Right. Yeah, well, he was actually almost desiring it because he thought that that would help him get some money.
Well, yeah, because he was very much in love. So.
Right. Okay. So the. So we're talking. So this. So you can wonder if George White gave him this drug. Maybe that's what he discovered later. You know, that it was that guy. I don't know, but it could be. But it would be someone. He found someone like that. Do you remember him, James, saying that it was someone like White, George White, that he discovered had given him the drug?
Someone like that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So if it's true that this was done to him, you can see, based on what I'm saying, how great he looked and how charismatic and smart he was, that they knew the one they wanted to nail. You know what I mean? They let Abby Hoffman and them run around, but not Walter. They wanted to get him. If that's what happened, I can understand why. That's what I'm trying to impart here, how impressive Walter was. And that was, you know, 10 years after the 60s when I met him in 79. Mm-hmm. But you guys don't have that experience. So, Ed, that's our preamble. You can begin your questioning.
Okay, so James, after it's been since November 2009 that you did your interview with Project Camelot regarding your experiences with Walter. And is there additional information since that time that you would like for people to know?
Yeah, sure. That one of the things that people don't know about him at all, very few people know, is that when I was living with him and we were roommates in Santa Monica, I had just started by more of the investigative purposes. I went straight into the Masons, and I decided, you know, I wanted to find out for myself what was really going on there, and I found out, and there's not a lot. So Walter Bowert actually was initiated into the Masons himself in Culver City. And he went through the initial steps. He was very interested in seeing the state of masonry in the U.S. and what was really going on there as myself, because he wanted to see from himself, because I told him what was going on in the process myself. And I was really not impressed, to say the least. So he wanted to go through that. I signed all his paperwork. I put him through. And then he, at the final... third stage of masonry, he became extremely conflicted. He had problems with the protocols. He wouldn't talk to Ed, master of the lodge, about it. He wanted me to talk to the master of the lodge on his behalf, because he didn't want to make the final speech necessary to get the final third degree, or the initial third degree, to become an actual mason. So he was initiated, went to the first and second degrees, and then he set a date to get the final third degree. And everybody was anxiously awaiting in the lodge because they figured out who he was. But then he decided, you know, he didn't want to memorize everything. He thought it was stupid. He had all sorts of problems with it, and he never finished it. But he went through there, and he basically told me after, you know, meetings that I had and so forth, that it's more like the Sufi religion or sect, and we started studying Sufism a lot after that and speaking about it, and that's where he would go into more about the shamanic experiences he'd gone through and so forth. So A lot of people don't know that. So they, a lot of people today, like, I haven't discussed that publicly anywhere on radio or anybody with anybody because of the labeling that's so attached to it. And he didn't either because I don't go to the lodge meetings. I don't participate in the lodge meetings. I don't even pay dues anymore. And he knew Walter knew I had problems with it, and he had problems with it, and I was just kind of, you know, turned off. But nobody knows that. Nobody knows that at all, that he was a Mason.
And it sounds like with Walter's interest in the Masons, he was doing research on them?
Yeah, he was, actually, because when I initially went through all the degrees and became a 32nd degree and went to the Scottish Rite, you know, I was telling him everything that was going on, and I was introduced to one of the advisors to the presidents, or three of the presidents, in a private meeting with some other Masons, and I told him that, and his ears flicked up and went, you did what? And I said, yeah, I met with, you know, this guy who has been an advisor to three presidents, and we had a private meeting, and he was immediately like, what's going on here? Because we're all young guys. We all raided the Beverly Hills Lodge, and there's a whole bunch of new activity happening. There's like 25 new memberships in less than a month, which is unheard of. And then he suddenly got very interested in what was going on because the level of people on the 33 degree level that I was introduced to, like Michael Richards from Seinfeld, that actor, and the advisor to the president, and, you know, at the head of the cops, and, you know, this power structure that was supposedly in there where they were supposed to be doing great things, and they weren't. I didn't see anything going on, so he kind of was discouraged with it, because in a traditional sense, he liked the concept of it, but he knew it was corrupt, and as all big organizations are these days. So he got turned off, and he said, you saw that, I've seen it, we don't need to check it out anymore, let's go on to the next thing, type of, that was the attitude, pretty much.
So, James, you joined Freemasonry, and how far did you get into it or stay
in
it?
I went to the 32nd degree.
And that was when? When did you do that? Before you met Walter? Oh, okay.
No, this was while I met him. I knew him. I raided the place to spy on it, essentially, to figure out what the big deal was. And I was reporting in to him, saying, "Look, this is what we did, and these are the rituals, and this is what's going on, and this is this person, that person, who's in there, and all that stuff."
So you started that after you met Walter.
That's right.
Right, and it was organized by you and Walter for you to do that?
Yeah, it was, actually, because I didn't see anything going on. I wasn't really interested in, I kind of figured out what it was about, or at least the lodge I was involved with. I can't say that about all the lodges, but the ones I've been involved with, I could see what was going on. And he said, no, you should check it out. And he was showing me different angles of it in terms of how it related to the Sufi belief system, and that's why I continued on with it. But then after that, I was kind of discouraged, and he got discouraged with it too. When he had to, we had to start complying to their rules of thinking and the rituals.
Right. So you're saying that Walter assigned you. He said, "James, we're going to investigate Freemasonry, and I want you to go in as a member." And then he got interested as you went through the early stages, so he joined up.
Yep, that's right.
And then you were going further, and he was monitoring what you were learning, and he was intrigued. But when you met the bigger people, Michael Richards and them, and nothing was happening around there, he got disappointed as well as you did.
Yeah.
Okay.
We didn't see the real value in this social network, because both of us have, you know, in the original traditional sense, that establishment is more of a shamanic thing, and there wasn't anything remotely to that at all. It may have been distorted or through the ages and times and whatnot, because he was looking about he was interested in the shamanic expressions through that happen in the steps of Freemasonry. He was studying that a lot and reading all about it and looking at Albert Pike and doing all this stuff. Well, I was telling him, you know, oh, I had to do this this time, and I had to do this this time, and then this is the symbol, and this is this, and blah, 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 blah. And he was taking notes.
So he joined eventually, but he only went so far, he couldn't take it, but you went all the way, and he got all the information on all that from you.
Right.
Right, because here's a pattern I get from this story. The relevance, what he learned in 66 on that trip, Walter then, from that point on, would engage different thought systems or different cults or different phenomena. And he was always relating it back to that experience, what he learned. He felt that he was the gold standard of understanding or assessing what was happening. So he probably got into McLuhan, even though he might have known before of McLuhan. He would go into any new thing that we'd talk about. It always would be eventually judged inadequate and not as important as what he experienced on his trip. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it was, okay. He left East Village other in late 67, early 68, goes out to Arizona, and he starts with Peggy, the Omen Press, around Sufi Sam. So always, Sufism, or the secret esoteric part of Sufism, was his religion, his standard of what was up. And it's interesting that he's still, 30 years later, in early, you know, last 10 years, he is figuring out if the Freemasons knew what he got, and he thought that Sufism and Sufi Sam, whose book he published, was the truth that you would compare everything to. Does that sound right?
Yeah, and also I'll add this to that. When he was studying that and telling me about the Sufis, he went and got me the book, The Sufis by Indre Shah, and he signed it this. He said, "The Brotherhood is ancient and has many names. Welcome to what you already are, K610 Kirby," which was his original birth certificate name, and then he signed it right there.
What's the date on it?
He didn't put a date.
Oh, okay, and what is the initial KC Kirby?
K610 Kirby.
K610 Kirby.
Yeah.
What's the 610?
Something that was on the birth certificate.
K6. His name was. Did it begin with?
Before he was adopted.
What'd you say?
His original birth certificate before he was adopted as Walter Bullard, you know. Because remember, he was not picked up right away. They had to give him it was a Kirby. So they put K610 in there, and then when his adoptive parents came in, then it was changed to Walter Bullard.
Okay, so his real father was a Kirby.
Yep, and his real father was also a Mason, and people don't know that either.
K610 is the name that his father gave him, or the institution did because they couldn't find the father?
The institution did, the adoption agency.
That's their code word. He's just another baby they found, so they call him K610, and that is on his birth certificate?
Yep.
And then, did he know his father? Why was he up for adoption?
I didn't get into that. I don't think. He told me about meeting his birth parents, but he didn't tell the nature of it, why he was given up for adoption.
Right, but he did, when he was taken on by the Bullard family and they named him Walter, he had the birth certificate, or eventually it was given to him when he was old enough, and it said on a K610 Kirby.
Yeah, because, you know, we got into this whole thing about the adoption process because I was going through the process of myself of meeting my genetic lineage, and he was interested because he had gone through that as well. We always compared adoption stories all the time. It was like a big thing with him.
Right. And if you take K610 and Kirby, K, the beginning of the K-16, in the K of Kirby, that's two, K is the 11th letter. So 211 is 22. KK, he's KK, he's 22. Don't know if he put that. What?
There you go. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, that's just within my code or my fake significance about 22. So here's, so when I met Walter in 79, we eventually, pretty quickly, I found out about his acid trip or whatever it was. And then I brought in this interesting aspect about cosmic awareness, saying that's the period that Ralph Doobie was dying in Hawaii with all these heart attacks and finally checked out in January 67. Don't know the exact date. And that's according to Worcester. So I mapped on, oh, Walter, you were part of the Rai Return in Essence, or you were picking up what was happening. He knew of cosmic awareness. He thought it was crazy stuff. He didn't get into it too much. And this is in 79. He had heard of it, but I don't know if he heard of the Worcester part or the later Paul Shockley part, but he said he used to get sent literature from them. So I would bring in the cosmic awareness facts as presented by Dave Worcester, and he was sort of interested. He didn't get really interested until 2004 when, and Ed started the recording, when he finally said, I got to talk to David. And he did, and he didn't record it. Then I found out later that day that he did, and I said, okay, record it tomorrow, because he said, I'm going to go back and record him. I said, ask him all this stuff. So I guided him, and you can hear that, right, Ed?
Yes.
That's on my timeline. Is that on your, did you put that on your, those two interviews or talkings with them on your site?
I don't think so.
Yeah, you can link to my timeline, and you can hear them.
Okay.
Anyways, what I presented to him in 79 and 80 was the, quote, new mysticism, the new implications of for the Sufi tradition that McLuhan had discovered, the whole discarnate electronic effect that upset the traditional secret esoteric wisdom, or this tradition he signed the book about. He says, this is what the Brotherhood always knew, right, and what you already are. I took McLuhan to question what he thought was significant. I said, the new mysticism or the new whatever effort to transcend what you're conditioned by and to tap into some immortal thing has to consider the electronic effect. And that's what McLuhan understood. McLuhan was an expert on Freemasonry and all this stuff. He was asked to join different secret societies, and he didn't take the bait. And he just observed them and knew that he was onto something more significant, or that something drastic was going to affect humanity that even the secret wisdom couldn't deal with. All right, that was the question that McLuhan posed to people, and nobody even got it to even consider it. But I was around to present it after McLuhan passed on. So that is the point I kept telling Walter. So that was part of the conflict. He's saying, it was implied that, Bob, you're saying that my trip in 66, which is the fountain of everything I know, and how Sufism and the secret esoteric wisdom of Sufism is the key to what happened to me, you're saying that ain't real. That isn't important. That was, and I said, yes, that's what I'm saying to you, Walter. And that was our debate, whether that was true or not, whether my question to what he was saying. So you see what I'm saying, James? Do you recall any of his discussions of me and McLuhan with that kind of, does it resonate? Do you get an echo of what I just said in your memory of the talks with
him? Yeah, it did, but it was, he leaned to the left, leaned to the right, and wavered back and forth and back and forth, because I was trying to figure out, many times I'm like, what are you saying? I'd reference, like, you just said this one time, one way, and now you're saying this. Like, he would constantly tell me, talk to Bob, and then one minute he goes, well, then he starts citing McLuhan, and he goes, just ask Bob, and then weeks or months later, at a different point, with a different temperament, he said, Bob is an idiot. He's got mental problems. He's a schizoid psycho. Don't even listen to the guy. And he get all serious about it. And I'm like, relax. really passionate. And then other times it'd be the complete opposite, the total opposite. And I'm like, what is the deal with these two? Because I could never understand the thing going on.
The what thing?
The wavering, going back and forth.
Right. And you also, he did not explain McLuhan to you, so you didn't have a good understanding of McLuhan to understand what his question was or what he was wrestling right?
He introduced me to that because he'd always use his quotes anytime he was walking around carrying coffee in his hand. All the time.
Carrying coffee, what?
When you walk around carrying coffee, you'd always cite McLuhan.
In other words, when he was in a relaxed mood, in a social situation maybe, I'm assuming, you know, you're at some institution when you're having coffee or just hanging out, when you go phatic, he would go into the McLuhan mood. But when he got paranoid, he'd go into the top-down mood, and he thought McLuhan wasn't relevant there, correct?
Right. They reference those two things.
Yeah, because Don Thiel wrote probably the best book of McLuhan called The Virtual Marsh McLuhan, and he talks about McLuhan's apparent, quote, schizophrenia or schizoidness. Not that Thiel wasn't saying he had a psychological problem, though there's a new book by Douglas Copeland. I don't know if they go into the schizophrenic part that Thiel points out, but Douglas Copeland, he's the one who created the term Generation X. He became famous doing that in, late 80s, early 90s, whenever that book came out. And he's a Canadian writer. He's now done a book of McLuhan, and he's saying McLuhan, all his insights and genius was a result of being autistic and psychologically different or unique or screwed up. He's saying that about McLuhan. So Don Thiel is not taking the term schizophrenia literally, but he's saying there was this split in McLuhan. And if you listen to my stuff over the year, you can say that I'm a psychopath or a schizophrenic. There is a contradiction to what I'm talking about. And the same was going on with Walter, because Walter understood McLuhan enough to get into that condition where you will look like to the public you're schizoid or to your friends. You know what I mean, James? You see this?
That's right.
And I give Walter credit for getting into that condition, because when you get into McLuhan point, or you understand what McLuhan's saying, you realize words don't get to the matter, and even books don't get to the matter, even electric media don't get to the matter, because it's all flowing under global theater conditions. So you would, if you were a sane, aware person, you would have to be at least schizophrenic, because you've got several bodies going. So that's what was fun with Walter. He knew the question. He didn't. He wasn't as comfortable about it as I was. I could say that I was faking the schizophrenic dilemma. That I knew. I was saying, look, here's the issue. You got to get to this point. I figured out how to relate to it, so I'm, quote, more balanced about it. Walter, to me, had not got to that point. But I'm not saying that I'm balanced, but I was more comfortable. When James started talking to me in 2002, he basically was saying, you know, trying to find out what McLuhan was about. So I started explaining it, and James got it explained to him. So I'm saying that I was, quote, balanced enough to explain why we looked crazy. Walter could not get to that. He did not have the command of the situation to say that, to sit down, James, and explain why he was saying these McLuhan quotes. Would you agree with that, James?
Yep, that's right.
That was the difference.
Right.
And then I put James into a dilemma, because James was hearing what I was saying and realizing, holy crap, Walter didn't get that. Bob gets it, but Walter didn't. And then James went through, like, 2004 or 2007, a divided situation in relation with me and Walter. Right, James?
Yep. That's right. It's because he had to answer for all that he had done. Writing the book, its influence, all those things, and then that being part of his identity and part of his dilemma and part of his kind of trying to deal with his adoption issue was a continuous thing, because I just heard about it again from his, you know, former, you know, girlfriend about it recently, that he would wrestle with that every day, almost.
Right. Yeah, I apparently wasn't adopted. I didn't have those emotional issues, whatever they are. Okay, say a little more, James, about that. Why do you think that he was so worried? Here's what it was. Walter showed up in the media in the 60s when there was mass media. It wasn't so fragmented. And it was important if you got on Walter Cronkite's news or something. You had an impact. you could call it the analog media phase. So he was famous for from that period. And then the fragmenting media comes in, and the multi-audiences, and you can be famous in your own little media world, and Dan Rather didn't even never would hear about you, right? You have niche audiences. I come into the niche audience phase, the later fragment phase in the 80s, so I never had to wrestle with a huge fame that he had. And Walter, he kind of welcomed the fact that this new fragmenting media allowed him to be a new person, and he didn't have to worry about the analog media phase of him being a major figure in the comic culture. But it seems, James, he still hadn't resolved that. He still thought he had that analog media going, that mainstream big effect, and that in the Quadrophenia situation, multi-body situation I described in my interview with Ed, that is there. There's still a major media. That's why people vote for a president. That's why they want some centralized image. But it's only one part of themselves, of their media diet. So can you come up with some stories, or how does that resonate? On the media level, now you understand me better than what Walter was presenting. Go into what you think of when you think of him wrestling with his ancient Operation Mind Control fame, and then his studying of the UFO abductee and all the latest fringe stuff.
Well, see, that was, the book, wherever he went, the book was in his way, basically, is what I saw, because he wanted me to represent that book professionally and deliver it, deploy it into the Hollywood scene and see what would happen. But he thought that the doors would open right away, and they didn't, and I told him exactly how Hollywood worked, and he couldn't believe that, and he couldn't stand with some of the ethics and protocol of dealing with Hollywood. So what he did is, when I started representing him, kind of agenting for him, he signed all his works, all his scripts, all his ideas were all signed over to me for a certain amount of time, and I was allowed to go out and see what the response was. And within the limitations of the contacts that I had. And he was always open for meetings, but one of the books that he was working on actually was the subject matter I presented in as to how Hollywood worked. And he was working on a book called The Hollywood Bible According to James about the function of media, my reaction towards it, the whole process of taking his work and filtering it through these bigger, larger media venues, film, because he really wanted to be a screenwriter. That was his goal, and he spent a lot of time writing screenplays, and he was just not received right, because every time that his work got somewhere, it was just too sophisticated, or they just didn't understand it, or he got lots of roadblocks in Hollywood, lots of them, with exception for Oliver Stone, which was the one person he really did want to meet, and we did meet him. But he had all sorts of problems. But at the same time, he got all sorts of curiosity out of people, because he met all sorts of people when he was out here that I introduced him to. And one of those people that... he met, that he had a significant influence on for a brief period, was a very famous model, male model, who was in a major cult that I happened to meet when I was working at the American Film Market in Santa Monica. I met this particular person who was in a cult, who was very famous in his field, number one in his field at that time, and I introduced him to Walter, and he was in a cult, a very, very powerful one in the South, and during that time, I said, listen, this is a guy that, we worked on cults with all the accessing cues and all the things you've been through and all the deprogramming that needs to happen, so I said, this is the guy that you need to speak to. So I made an introduction of this particular gentleman to Walter, and then he started basically doing the defragment process with him, and...
You mean he started to heal? He started to heal the guy, right?
Basically, yeah.
Tried to heal him, to help him. Walter saw this guy was damaged because he was in a cult, correct?
Right, correct. So that relationship bled through to other things, new introductions to other people. It really kind of, that was a great time for him because he was getting, he started to get invited to dinner parties like the one I spoke about earlier in Bel Air. And then he had met with some of the civil rights leaders' families and all these different people. And so that was a great time for him, and he thought it was going to break through. And I was, you know, essentially agenting for him and discussing matters and all that. And he took this particular supermodel, and as we call it back then, and started to heal him and went through the healing process. And that's when I saw, you know, his skill sets about what he was capable of doing and his understanding of that whole process of getting meshed into that. So I was like, wow, he is Operation Mind Control himself. He's like going into this individual who had been deeply embedded into a cult for many, 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 many years, was very famous in his field, and he was the trigger man, basically, to get this guy out. And I was the conduit that introduced him. I said, this is person A, person B. And then I started to watch Walter unravel this guy. Had a tremendous influence, not only on the entire cult, but the friends of his, everything.
Did the guy appreciate what Walt, did he feel that he needed help?
Initially, no.
He didn't know he had a problem, but then he's listening to Walter's ideas, and Walter starts to tell him, basically, you got screwed up, right?
Right.
And
right.
Then the guy started to believe it, and then he wanted to be helped.
That's right. And then he got out to a certain point. It caused a bunch of chain reactions with people within the cult. There was millions of dollars at stake of money. Other people that were in the cult who were later introduced to Walter. It's essentially, as soon as Walter came in, the whole thing broke up into pieces. He did have an influence in shutting down the whole thing.
Because this famous model was is like John Travolta. These are money sources for the cult, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
These people around the famous model wanted him to stay in it and not be disrupted because they could, pay tithe him. He paid tithes or something.
Yeah. Yeah. He financed the whole thing. So. I introduced him to him, and Walter cleaned up that mess. He came in for a short burst of time. He even did, I remember him doing, this cult member, we did mushrooms with him. We went out with six or seven Masons plus this guy out into the desert, and during that experience, I saw that really was where he was home in the psychedelics experience. Completely, totally different guy. Incredibly telepathic, had remarkable abilities. I experienced it hands-on for myself, and I saw what he did for this guy. Because it was not long after that he kind of... started to walk away from this guy, and this guy...
Wait. James, who did what? Too many he's. Say it again.
Walter influenced this famous person, and I saw the shamanic things that he did with him during that mushroom experience in the desert, and it was not long after that the whole cult broke up. This guy pulled out. He got a settlement. It really changed his life, and all of his friends that he did have all broke away. The guy completely broke away from everybody he knew and went on to his own, and then nobody was talking to anybody. So he basically he got this guy out, and then after that he didn't have any real relationship with him after he got out of it. Everybody left everybody alone.
Right. Did this guy continue being successful?
No, he did not. It ended his career. He lost all of his money. He eventually got a small settlement. He was writing a book about his experience.
As a model or as a cult member? He was the experience of a cult member or
both.
As a model?
Both.
Both.
mind. If he, that book, I haven't read it, so I'm not sure if Walter's even mentioned in that or not, but that's really what happened.
Yeah, what I get from this, James, Walter, this is what's interesting. He was skillful in what I call astral body matters. You know what I mean? When you go to Peru and have the shaman take you through the ayahuasca and all that, Walter could be a shaman, you would say.
Oh, he was. I know he was.
Right. So he understood that. So here he is. I'm calling that a mastery of astral body matters, or, you know, non-physical matters. At the same time, he's got to deal with the paranoid world of Big Brother, which the Operation Mind Control, that book brought him in touch with. We had to deal with that. So that's the public world, public space. And then he has the media space, and he wants to just be a lowly screenwriter in that world. So that we'll call that his TV body. And then he personally wants to start the Eat, Fill, Each Other, have it a new digital presence, have a website. But he was very ornery about working with computers, and he wouldn't go corporate with the computers, so he'd go Linux or something. It was always breaking. But he was trying to establish a presence. Look at the Quadrophenia, trying to establish a presence in the chip landscape with having his own Freedom Foundation and Return of Each Village Other. Remember him talking about that?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then he wanted to be an employed screenwriter doing good stuff, and he had a problem with that because he wanted complex dialogue, and he couldn't believe the simplicity that Hollywood would require in the dialogue. He wanted to put more ideas out, but he was trying to get his stuff out there on the TV landscape. And then he had his journalistic landscape, which is the Operation Mind Control, confronting the New York Times and the general public consensus about what's what and who's being controlled. And then he had his astral body expertise. See, that's pretty comprehensive. And it explains his juggling of all these aspects. And you knew him as a guy trying to get into Hollywood, and then all of a sudden you see him doing his expertise with the cult guy, cult victim.
Yep. But I'll say, more than any research that he did, any book publishing, his true talent was with shamanic and as a shaman. He was really, really good. Really good. I saw it, and I was introduced to a whole other thing about him that was quite remarkable. That impressed me more than anything that he did.
Do you have a date on that? Did that happen in your early years at Santa Monica, or by 2005?
That
must be before he went to San Francisco when he was ill, right?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's 2000, 2001, or 2002. Was it after 9/11?
I believe so, yeah.
Right, so probably 2002, because he was back in the, you know, in the hospital by 2003, I think. He's up in San Francisco for about 2 years, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Right, so this is that's why Walter was so interested in psychiatry and the mind control issues there. But he was, what's the name of that guy, Colin, somebody that he really respected?
Ross. Colin Ross is his name.
R-O-T-H. Yeah, so he could talk their language. He was interested in improving psychiatry and psychology, and always sort of complaining about what it is, and they don't know this. So he actually wanted to bring, he was like an R.D. Lang, you want to bring some shamanism into modern psychiatry, right?
That's correct. That's right.
And that's why he studied hypnosis. He said, okay, there's something. He already could handle subtle hypnosis as a shaman, but he took on the institutional meme of hypnosis and got a certificate in it, right?
That's right.
Do you want to go into a bit of what came out of that? Oh, what'd you say?
Oh, yeah, well, when he started HMI in Tarzana.
Here's a thought, James. It's like Walter. He didn't need to do anything. He could be a shame. He could be a life coach today, right? This whole thing of being a life coach. He could be that. But he was always trying to make an impact in the Android meme or the major media or in regular institutions. Would you agree?
Yes.
He was not satisfied just being a life coach.
Not at all.
He was a media phenomenon. He's a major figure in creating alternative culture or alternative media, right? So that's his legacy, and he wants to complete that. I would call that the TV landscape and the TV body. He wanted to complete that major media imagery. and complete whatever he thought he was doing with each village other. At the same time, the digital landscape fragmented all that and made it not so important. And it also marginalized Walter because anybody else could start a website and claim they're an expert in mind control, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so go into the him trying to infiltrate the hypnosis world.
Okay, so I saw him begin that process. He started going to school when I was roommates with him in Santa Monica. So he started the HMI there.
What's HMI?
Hypnosis Motivation Institute in Tarzana, California. And he was immediately interested in that particular operation there because he knew that people from the agency came and trained there, and they even admitted it, that their Central Intelligence Agency was there and that other people on that level were coming to train there. So he went there.
Okay, hey, I get an idea, James. This is an example. He would take notes when he heard from the model about the model's life and cult, right? He was always being one-fourth of himself, so to speak, the journalist, and he would pretend he's a student, but he was investigating the HMI while he was being a student, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay, I just wanted to get that on record. So
right.
Tell us about it.
He wanted the credentials. He wanted to go through that, but he wanted to investigate the place while he was doing it. And during that time is when the big thing happened. He met the love of his life at HMI, and it was during that time he started to get, he was getting sick, and he met the love of his life while he was at HMI. Who was married? Yeah, who was married, and he actually introduced me to a couple of women that he was very, very interested in, like, having a relationship with. He says, go check them out and tell me what you think. You know, he wanted my opinion on that. So I went out into the field, and I met one of them, and I met the other one, and then it was the one that I approved of that actually was at school with him at HMI while he was going through the hypnosis process. And he found, he discovered a lot, actually, during that time, and he used me as a subject for hypnosis. He tried it on all those people. He was trying to see how it could be better. He thought it was very, it wasn't bringing other technologies like NLP or Gestalt thinking or anything else into the model in which they were teaching. So he thought it could be improved, even though he's going to the class and, you know, saw all the demonstrations, everything. He thought it could be improved.
Okay, James, let me interject here. And in 1985, I went out to Palm Springs, and that's when he was with Becky, and that's about a year after JJ was born. He's born on James Joyce's birthday. Is that an own story here? This story is, here's the literary Walter Bauer. His wife is pregnant, and I guess on February 1st, she's going into labor. And Walter told me, and she confirmed it, that Walter said, hold off the labor. The baby's coming through, but hold it off. We got to get to midnight, so it's February 2nd, James Joyce's birthday. I got to have my kid born on James Joyce's birthday. And he pulled it off. Did he ever tell you that story?
No, I never heard that one. See, there's one I didn't hear about.
Yeah, that's why, his son Weiss was called, the nickname back when he was a kid was JJ for James Joyce, because he was so happy that his wife held back and then popped the baby out, you know, once he got past midnight, February 2nd, into February 2nd. Okay, in that period, he was, I was with him, Carol and I visited him, and he was just finishing NLP or in the middle of it, and he was very impressed with Tony Robbins. And
yes,
see, that's, even though everything is Sufi and he's a shaman and he's pretty skillful at helping people go through drug trips and all that, he could take in something new, and so he was impressed, and he got a degree. I think in 85, he had just gotten a degree, graduated as NLP, whatever that offers, right? There's such a institutional thing around that, right?
Right.
And so then NLP was the big deal from 85 to 90, And when I was visiting in Paradise, where is Paradise, James? New Mexico or Arizona?
Arizona.
Arizona, but right near the Four Corners or where they meet or something. What's the name of those mountains? Chichawa? Chikawa?
I know what you're referring to, but
It's approximately Chikawa Mountains. So that's where Paradise is. So we're there in his cabin in September 90, and he's going on about NLP. So I brought up the McLuhan rebuttal of NLP. First I should say this. When I met him in 85, he said, Tony, I think he knew Tony or talked to him, or maybe this was just what Tony was lecturing about. But Tony was trying to figure out something, and when I brought in the word consonants, there's dissonance and then consonants. He didn't know that word, and I mentioned to him. He goes, wow, that's it. That's the word that Tony needs. And I don't know if he ever told Tony about the dialectic between dissonance and what? Well, consonants. So he's very inspired about me giving this word or coming up with the word consonants. And I don't know what happened between him and Tony about that. But here it is, and 5 years later, I'm with him in Paradise, Arizona, and we get into our argument about whether McLuhan's relevant or not. And I basically said to him, okay, you help someone with NLP. You do a retreat or something, they go through and they get code healed or improved or something. They go back to work in their office, and they got to answer the phone, and by then computers are coming in, and they got cable TV, got all this media coming at them. I said, Walter, within a couple of weeks, they'll have forgotten the effect of NLP, and they'd be confused again. So I said, well, your NLP therapy is not long-lasting. If you understood McLuhan, if McLuhan's meme was taught in high school, not so much now, it's a whole different situation, nothing matters now, but back then in 1990, if kids were taught about the media dynamics, then they'd have a psychological awareness of it, and that would be a better therapy than any little particular therapy about why they can't have a soul lover or something, and how do I make more money? All those human potential psychology things, which NLP is supposed to give you power about. If you knew the McLuhan level, that would be more therapeutic in the long run. So that was my position. So we argued, and basically, Carolyn was observing this, and she told me after, you got through to him, Bob. He got it. He realized that what I was saying was relevant more than he did before. And so I noticed in the 90s, he would bring in the McLuhan point, not really get into it. He'd bring it in. So he had allowed it in, and that was always there. And that's why he would go to any new therapies like hypnosis and know that they weren't as important. Part of him, he would think that it's not as important as the McLuhan insight. Does that help to see how he would talk to you? Do you get what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
It's obvious now, but back then it was confusing to you how he presented. But so he always went in to fix everything, like since he was a teenager. He had this, you could say a messiah complex or a super confidence. He understood it, and maybe he was good at shamanism because apparently in his diaries he was interacting with a spirit when he was in high school. You know what I mean? He was including the paranormal perception in his life, and that would be pretty unique in the 50s. It just wasn't in the public's consciousness. I mean, privately people were doing all kinds of nutty stuff or experiencing strange stuff, but it wasn't talked about. Well, Walter, so he'd have that awareness. You know what I mean, James?
Yep.
And then he went and meditate in the jungle in the early 60s. That'll make you pretty smart in some ways. You'll be able to live without the whole media environment or industrial environment. You know how you can survive under that. That's an accomplishment. So he was caring, bringing all this stuff, and then he went in and started his theater. And the theater was the East Village Other, and it was totally a theatrical thing. So he was coming back to help, save, improve, whatever, America. And he did that all his life. Would you agree?
Basically. Yep. Pretty much.
So the problem was he finally gets to Hollywood, and he's not making it big, in the screenplay thing. It's not happening, so he can shift over into his therapeutic self and go into hypnosis and study that.
Right.
But that...
being in love.
well, that was the big thing. When he finally met someone that, for some reason, he really loved them or wanted them and couldn't have them because she was married, that caused a problem in him, right?
caused a big problem. Caused a problem with me, caused a problem with everybody around him. When the death process started with him, and he knew he was ill, and then...
But James, hold it. He already was ill in 2002 and 2003, but that was the gallbladder, gallstone, or thing that even Carolyn had talked about back in 1990 or something, way back there. That thing led to that operation in 2003 or so, right? That's a different sickness.
Then the big questions are happening. I didn't get into this into the other interview as well, but because for, I would say, 70% of the time I knew Walter, he was, his health was deteriorating worse and worse and worse. On some
right, and so, James, let me put the time thing. So you meet him in 2000 or so, where he's living with you. That leads to him being in San Francisco for a year or more, having that internal surgery, right?
Right, that's right.
Then he comes back, and I met you in February 2005. Walter was now back in L.A., and he's going to be there for the next almost three years. And then he gets into a second illness, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yes,
go into that.
During this time, his whole personhood changed again, because now he's aware he's dying. He knows it. He's creating it. He knows it. He's aware of it. He's going through this whole death cycle, and he meets the woman of his dreams that he totally changes his life. He almost turns into a different guy. I didn't get to ever see anything like this, because he knew he became more picky about how he'd spend his time and who he'd spend his time with. He was caused all these problems with him. He was very kind of in turmoil to the very, very end, because he felt like he arrived. It was the most important thing that ever happened to him. I remember him sitting on the couch that I'm sitting on right now and saying, hey, just remember, like the Beatles said, love is all you need. That's all you need. That's all you need. And he kept doing this all over and over again, and he was very much in love, and it was great to see him go through that, but he couldn't have it the way he wanted to have it. It was like a very restrictive, difficult, conflicting situation. But yeah, I remember him telling me, this is the best thing that ever happened to me, because I finally found somebody that believes in me.
Right, and that
was major.
Yeah, this is the orphan part of himself. He finally made contact with a human on a one-to-one love level that he wouldn't have as an orphan, right?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, whatever abandonment issues.
All that stuff came up. Everything came up. It was like bacteria coming, the disease coming to the surface and being flushed all out. It was a really, really interesting time to see him change in so many different ways. Because one minute he'd be the happiest guy in the world, and then a month later, you know, then he'd be going and having tests at the hospital. But the interesting part that I did not speak about is during the death process as it started, he was taking notes on all the drugs that they were administrating him.
Yeah, he was investigating the beginning.
Yeah, again. And he'd tell me, sit down with me, he says, hey, he told me about the entire story about how they completely got rid of all the testosterone in the system, and how he got to feel what it was like to be a woman, like with estrogen and the whole thing. And he is writing notes explaining to people what it's like and what the real problems that men have. It was this whole thing. And I was like, oh, my God. I was listening to it the way he said it, because it's a lot easier not to have that, you know, that oomph drive thing. And he was trying to explain it to me how it is when you're without testosterone because of the drugs that they're giving him. And then he spent an enormous amount of time investigating the drug Versed, which he discovered and told me would be the drug of choice by the intelligence agencies to use to create or block and remove memory of everything, just like they use it in surgery. So all the time he's getting, you know, this, he's in love, he's investigating what these drugs are doing. He's doing all this stuff at the same time. He's writing at this time. He's trying to establish himself still as a screenwriter during this whole time. So all the
and doing Soma, which we'll get into a little later, but that whole corporate thing that you and I, more you than me, were involved in. But I want to say this, James, is that I'm thinking that Walter is like Salvador Dali's, I think it was called the paranoid schizophrenic method, that Dali talked about this. Walter was, from day one, probably when he got to high school, suspicious about everything and analyzing and making sure he wasn't set up. He brought that to New York City in the late 50s, and he never stopped. And so he would interact with society, whatever institutions came into his life, and he would investigate it while he was using it or needed it. That never stopped, and he was always thinking out philosophically definitions of things, right?
Mm-hmm. He'd always ask, you know, he'd show me the drugs, what they were, how they administered, what they can do, and then he'd ask me, after he's finished telling me, what am I not seeing, James? What am I not seeing? Tell me. Like, that's why he'd introduce me to his girlfriends or whoever. I want you to come on this meeting and tell me, because he wanted to make sure he wasn't missing anything, because we both had intuitive skill sets that were slightly different, but born of the same circumstances and things of that nature. So he would always be like looking behind the curtain, always.
He was always intelligent. He was always into awareness, and that made him really fun to be with. If you were into that stuff, he always had even in the last dark period, so to speak. Even though it was the greatest part of his life, he always was fun to hang out with, right?
Always, always. I could introduce him to anybody. I introduced him to young people, older people, famous people, and he got along with everybody. Always.
Yeah.
And they're always fascinated by him what guy comes up and says, "Hi, I'm a chemical eunuch," and introduces himself to. And he told the entire dinner table about what it's like to be a chemical eunuch. I remember, and I was like, "What is he doing?" I was.
Yeah. No privacy issues.
No. It's just like he's very. He didn't care at that point because he was dying and he knew it.
But he did. I saw him do this, you know, in 1985 in Palm Springs. Some young college student came over, and I think I mentioned it in my interview. And we're just talking, and of course Walter's leading the conversation and going all over the place and making discoveries. And all of a sudden the kid goes, "Wait a minute, we studied you in college." And we go, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, you did these studies together. I took a course in alternative journalism or something, and it was a lot about you." And Walter says, "Yeah, I did that." So the guy's stunned, the kid's stunned about this, and then Walter probably told him incredible stuff, you know, revealing stuff about Walter, and destroyed his image in front of the kid because he never stopped being sort of honest about himself and just telling what he was interested in. I mean, it just went... The kid probably never recovered from the conversation. He never attacked the kid, just that Walter would do stuff like whatever the issue, probably talking about NLP, probably brought in some McLuhan level because I was there. As you say, in a dinner party, he'd be saying, "I'm a chemical eunuch." He did that always, every day. He was on duty, so to speak. And it didn't matter who you were. If you said you knew something about him, he said, "Okay, well, here's what we've learned so far. This is 20 years later since these killed each other. This is what we know now."
He went crazy when he went and took the Percet drug for his surgery, because he made the doctors tell him what these drugs were about, and he asked where they came from. He'd interview his doctors about the chemical part of the surgery, and when he took Percet, he said, "This is something... There's something going on with this." He's extremely interested and spent a lot of time investigating that because of the applications of it, not only for a person's health, but what it could be done in terms of the removal of the neural pathways and the stuff that sets up memory and trauma to the body. All these things that you could remove sections of people's lives with this thing. So he's very interested in Percet for a long time.
And so that paranoid part, which is justified, about what Big Brother was doing, was always being assessed as he got new information. You need this, Walter, to make you feel better. He'd take it all, it has that effect. How could the CIA use this? You know, and he'd be continuing the Operation Mind Control meme that he created. And that led to making the second revised edition in the 90s, before you met him, and then he sort of kept updating it, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And then, and you know, there, I don't know what the final copy was, but it does have a lot of McLuhan stuff in the final copy, which is not at all in the first version. You know, he had the tetrad, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And then that, okay, so then that would go into Soma, because that was him being a therapist on another level for Hollywood. Go into what you guys thought you were doing with that.
So we sat down, and at this point, he was he finally found a partner in a woman that he thought he could do business with and have a relationship with, and he wanted to set up a corporation where I would be the director of public affairs, he'd be chief executive in charge, and he wanted to create a corporation that was unlike any other corporation ever created ever.
Yeah, now James, at that point in 2005 or so, this is about 2005 when you set it up?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because you called me, we'd talk every 6 months, and you'd give me your view of what was going on with Walter. It was like we were both infiltrating Walter and studying him and reporting back to each other, right?
Right.
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 So you told me to be on the board of this corporation and trying to explain, you know, there's this other woman or something. I didn't get it. There's some woman, and I don't know if you were concerned about the woman or not at right away, but I was not told about the emotional thing that Walter was getting into with this woman. And so I did not know that's why this woman was on the board at that time.
Well, no, that's why she was there. She was a medical doctor and still is, and he totally wanted her there. She was a big influence of it even lifting off the ground. But she was more there as an observer and a companion, not so much somebody that would be adding any technology into it, so to speak.
Yeah, she was there for someone that he trusted.
Yeah,
she was
right.
The trust factor. And I think the reason I didn't know the situation is that you didn't go into it because you were a bit confused about what was happening to Walter and didn't know what to say about it. You were just observing it, right?
Right, exactly. Because I knew it would never be completed. I knew that he would.
Yeah, because she had a husband, and Walter eventually ended up being at their home as a guest, right?
They were going on a little ride together, but they know the ride wasn't going to, you know, they weren't going to get to where they wanted to go, but they wanted to go on the ride anyway. So I went along for the ride, and said, let's set up this company. And the reason it was called Soma Corporation is because both of them had a relationship with the mushroom, the sacred mushroom. And one of Walter had taken the sacred mushroom, and she had not. Yet the physical, visual aspect of the mushroom, because she'd collected them when she was a little girl, had been there her whole life. So what was?
But she didn't. Did she know about the psychedelic effects of mushroom? Psychotropic effects?
None. Zero.
She didn't know that. So she learned that her childhood hobby had another dimension when she met Walter.
Exactly. So, and he was the shaman for her because she was very limited in her thinking based upon her cultural conditioning. So,
she was not born an American.
Right. So,
but she was a doctor. She was a pretty good doctor, right?
Yeah, very good doctor, yeah. So that part was the journey that they were going on. They were kind of journeying without doing the mushroom themselves, each other. I had done them with Walter, so I understood it. But so we called it Soma Corporation for Semiotic Off-Screen Media Arts. And
Semiotic Off-Screen Media Arts.
Yeah, that's right. Filed it as a California corporation. And then what occurred after that was he put together that kind of opening kind of statement of what he wanted the company to be, and it basically was he wanted the company to be a tool where we would go and consult with filmmakers, people that make commercials, radio, whatever media environments, and use it to create programming that would be therapeutic for the participant rather than some of the destructive things that were out there, according to a lot of people. And he was interested in using, creating, he had the connections, actually, because we were talking about it, He had the connections. I didn't at that point, but he wanted to take all of this to George Lucas and said he could get to George Lucas because he wanted to create another platform, kind of like what James Cameron did with his new technology application in the film environment. He wanted to come in with something entirely different so they could he could assess the screenplay from all the language patterns in it. We could create new ways of using sound in a movie theater and add something other than the acoustic visual experience that the movie theater is, maybe adding another sense into it to make it the effect of a movie more powerful than it is today, but and a big but, to make the person, as they go through the film experience, go through a therapeutic experience. So that when they come out of the movie theater, they will have gone through the trance like everybody does, but that they're going to feel a longer-lasting, better feeling about themselves. So every time they swim in film media, they're going to be, and their value system will be improved. They'll have a better self-esteem, et cetera, et cetera. And he wanted to, that was the point of the company, is to come in and use what he knew and use what technology was available to come in and go to film companies and radio and television and all that and use the media as a tool for healing. That was
right.
The goal of that company.
Yeah, now, in other words, putting sort of better holistic subliminals in it?
Something in it, yes. I mean, to make sure that the suggestion of violence and racism and all the things that make up these ideas about who everybody thinks we are and put them in a better light.
Okay, so around that time, you said, Bob, we want Walter. I don't know if Walter asked me, but I think you did on behalf of him. Said, Bob, why don't you, if you're McLuhan expertise, to be on the board. So you sent me the perspective, the abstract, the statement. I read this and I said, what a bunch of nonsense. What the hell is Walter trying to do? That was my reaction at first, but I went along. I infiltrated you and Walter and said, well, I'll pretend I'll be on the board and find out what the hell they think they're talking about. And so I went along with it, and we discussed it. So eventually, once I was sort of on the board, Walter would eventually call me. Do you remember this? He would call me and say, Bob, you're on this board, and we're going to do this, and we're going to be doing this and that. Do you remember those conversations with me?
Yeah, I heard about him, but I knew none of it was going to happen. So
right, yeah. By that time, no, that's another factor. By that time, you knew that Walter was a life of pipe dreams, so to speak.
Right.
That he screwed up with his Hollywood introductions that you brought to him, and you weren't too enthusiastic about any of his new projects because you didn't think you knew that he probably would screw it up, right?
Yeah,
that's what you're saying.
He wasn't. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I remember discussing the ideas in the abstract or whatever he sent me, and I would start explaining the problems of what he was thinking of doing, how silly it is, and we don't even need to do that kind of therapy. And as we talk about it now, it all crystallizes. He's still trying to take his 1966, early 67 experience and put it into the population in some form, right? He wants to give them the great drug trip. And you know, by 2005, it was common knowledge that computers were like drugs, and it was a matrix phenomenon. That comes out in 1999, right? So computers and drugs, Terrence McKenna go into this, are interchangeable, right? So Walter's an expert on drugs, so okay, let's make the movie thing a holistic, ecological drug experience. Would you agree with that?
Yep.
So I would always discuss with him the bigger aspects of media and how I've told him how silly this project is, and it's not even, okay, so I critiqued it, and that would get him in a rage, which you would experience, right? Bob's an idiot. He doesn't know. We better not talk to Bob. We'll never get anything done with this project if we talk to Bob. We'll keep him on the board. We might need his information at some point, but let's not talk to him. And all the time, and I didn't know this till later, you were saying, okay, yeah, we'll do that, Walter, but you were as, quote, cynical as I was about it.
Yeah, because
for personal reasons.
Never, none of it was ever going to happen. None of it was ever going to happen, and his... The major force of the last section of his life was his relationship with this woman.
Yeah, so it was like, it was, his calling card is to help the world, save the media environment or something, and he's impressive with that effect, And so now he meets the love of his life. He's got to have that part of himself, the public media savior, going on so they can talk about that. But what's more important to him is that it doesn't matter whether that project happens. He wants to connect with the woman.
That's right.
That's his own subliminal agenda with her.
Yes.
So can you talk some more about what came out of that relationship, like once he started living with her and her husband?
Well, he thought this was the most influential woman in his life, the best thing that ever happened to him. He was at his most happy, but his most frustrated at the same time, throughout the time, because he had made two major operations. He had severe health problems. He had to yield and submit in a way that he wasn't used to doing. He had to go through all the process of all the chemicals he had to take for all the various procedures that he had to take, and all that stuff was going on. And it was more of a frustrated issue with him. But at the very, very end, when in the final weeks when I saw him, he said it was the best thing that ever happened to him. And he was thought that she was one of his biggest teachers ever on the nature of the human experience. So he was thankful for it, but he took a stalemate position at the very end, because at the very end of this, he told me the same day he did his last interview ever, his last recorded interview with any subject person. He told me the same day that it's kind of like a stalemate. Don't get into one of these. Like, don't create a scenario where you have an experience like this. And he kept telling me, and it was right at that time that he interviewed his final interview with that Vietnam vet.
Go into that bit, because you witnessed that, and that was in this woman's backyard, right?
That's right. It was in this woman's backyard. And
you watched Walter. You know, I haven't heard the tape, but you told me about it. You saw Walter was still on point intellectually discussing issues. He still was the knowing person, right?
Very much on point. And I had just returned from Peru, where I did something that he had never done, and he essentially introduced me to, and that was ayahuasca. I just returned after doing a whole cycle there. And the person that, one of the people that I met there, was a Vietnam vet with all sorts of various ailments from, you know, war syndrome and battle stress and things of that nature. And I knew that they would get along and they would bond immediately, and I was exactly right. So I brought this guy over to this woman's house, and we were sitting in the backyard, and Walter and this particular gentleman started to go into a language I didn't even know what they were talking about. They went through the 60s, the LSD experience, shape-shifting, time travel, aliens, everything you could think of in a conversation. And I initially was looking at it like, what is happening here? Because I never saw him pull out a tape recorder on anybody spontaneously until this guy. And what I recall is, I didn't know until later, but one of the things that initiated Operation Mind Control was his interview of people coming back from the war, a Vietnam vet, actually. And it was that thing that triggered Operation Mind Control. So the irony of all is that his final interview was with a Vietnam vet that had dismemberment of the body, severe post-traumatic stress disorder, a whole massive range of psychedelic experience already, and I saw him bond with this particular gentleman like I've never seen him do that with somebody before, ever, like he did with this guy. And I knew something was happening when he asked me to go get the tape recorder, and then he proceeded to go into his 40-day acid trip and what happened there with this guy. And he understood it and knew exactly what he was talking about. So as I saw these two staring at each other really closely, talking for almost 3 hours about that experience. Now, I hadn't I'd heard this a million times before, and because he mentioned it all the time, and then as I saw this unfold before me, I knew that tape would be a historical thing to have. And he was writing notes and asking questions as he was getting into his particular life, because he obviously knew that this guy had similar experiences or knew something that most people would not. Took a keen interest in him.
Was this guy the same age as Walter?
He was at that time 57.
So this is 2007. It's just a few weeks, 3 weeks before Walter transitions, right?
Yeah, he got him right at the end. It was pretty close.
So let's say November 2007, Walter would have been 68. And this guy was 57. So he's 10 years younger, right? If you said he was 57 at the time, the Vietnam vet.
Yeah, thereabouts, yeah.
Right, so the guy would be a victim of all the issues that Walter grew up with, especially the Vietnam War is a key point for Walter when he's doing the Eat, Fill, Each Other. So here is a guy, he's younger, but he went through the Vietnam War, and he went through all the things Walter was interested in. And do you have a copy of this tape?
No, I don't. I know it exists, but as you know, I'm trying to retrieve that.
Still trying to get it, so you haven't got it yet. But this tape would be the archetypal representation of all that Walter thought about based on that 1966 drug trip and all the things he studied and learned. That's an important tape for understanding Walter's thinking, because this interview was a replay of his concerns. Let's say he's in the 60s, Vietnam War is happening, he's pissed about that. He's trying to bring a media angle to it, and he starts Eat, Fill, Each Other. He's trying to help his generation and younger who were going to the Vietnam War, right? So he's trying to save them, trying to get them not to go to the war. And then the Vietnam War after image in the 70s, he deals with that, and that leads to Operation Mind Control. So it was always about that. So that's the poetry here, the symmetry. The original issue, the Vietnam War, comes back, and that guy had done a lot of stuff and had similar interests as Walter did over the subsequent 40 years, from 67 to 2007.
This Vietnam vet knew, he goes, you're the guy that did the anarchist cookbook? to this particular Vietnam vet, that was a major deal, because he wasn't sure who he was talking to initially.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, he kind of knew that he was, you know, a big guy in the 60s, but he really, the impact happened about an hour later.
Which we witnessed a lot. We witnessed, that's what was sort of humble about Walter. People, they were influenced by Walter and didn't know it, and then when they met the guy, they didn't know that was the guy, and then they'd be amazed when they found out, right? But they would find out if the conversation got that way, but Walter kept still sort of a low profile. It wasn't a big issue that he had done that, sort of.
Right, that's right. And then when this Vietnam vet
realized who he was?
Realized who he was and started talking about his own shamanic experience, then the conversation took on a totally different tone. They were like brothers now. That's when, you know, the tape recorder was already going, and he started taking notes after that point about what the interchange that was going on between the two of them.
I've never seen him do that before. You never seen him what? Take notes?
Not like that when he's interviewing with somebody. No, no way.
It's almost like you saw him take notes before when he's in an institutional situation, but he was faking being interested, faking taking notes. You know what I mean? Because he was investigating who was speaking, and the notes was the cover that he was listening, pretending he was listening. But you're saying he really wanted to know this guy.
Yeah, this guy was a very, very integral part of Walter's life at the very end there. He really listened closely. I was just like, I knew they would connect, but I didn't think they would connect that much. They were real close, real close.
And that guy is in your apartment right now?
No, he actually left yesterday. He's since been a still close friend, and I actually discussed with him yesterday. I said, I proposed the idea of, you know, you ever want to address the final interview you had with Walter publicly, and he didn't say yes, but he didn't say no, and so he's seriously considering it.
Yeah, it's not the interview he had, the dialogue he had with Walter.
Exactly.
It was a two-way dialogue, right?
That's right.
So,
talking about shamanistic archetypes and the jaguar entering the body and what happens when the snake coils up from ayahuasca under the upper crowns and going, when all the stuff that's like, most people wouldn't even understand it at all.
But Walter never did ayahuasca.
No, he didn't. But he had done, you know, multiple amount. He'd done stuff that other people had never done. He'd had the sacred mushroom, had the LSD, and both of them had had that. And he was interested in what ayahuasca had taught him as well.
Oh, that's why he's taking notes. He knows you've had it. He now has a guy who can talk in terms that Walter's interested in and the impact on the whole guy's life of this ayahuasca. So he was taking notes, like trying to get the experience vicariously through this guy's knowledge.
Oh, absolutely. We both of us just came fresh out of the womb, so to speak. So we're right.
You and the Vietnam vet.
Yes, yeah, because we both had the same shaman. We were both in the same circle and the whole thing. So him going through that was very interesting because he didn't get to do that.
Yeah. So, but you were, you had not spoken to Walter for about a year before that, right? This was a little bit of a reunion for you and Walter.
He was fully in his relationship with her, and he drifted off to the side. I'd still talk to him on the phone maybe once a week, a couple times a week, and then there was phone fade, and he was really in her life. He was very much a couple, so to speak, and I was
So now you know he's dying, and you see him again, and then it's a very interesting dialogue happens in front of you. What do you think about that in retrospect, since you knew he might die, right, soon?
No, I knew he was going to die.
But you must have been interested in how he was still working when the opportunity came up. Still investigating.
I was, but I knew that it was like a lightning bolt hit the room when he was talking to this Vietnam vet, and I'd never seen them react like that to somebody.
Here's an instant theory, James. Here's an instant theory. He's really, that stuff is not as important as his relationship with the doctor, female doctor. So what he did, he's in that, and the dilemma of that, the stalemate with this woman, and then he's going to redo his public concerns, his public all the stuff he's interested in, is going to be redone with this guy, while you know he's relating it to the real dramatic thing in his life, this new relationship, right?
That's right.
Go ahead.
He was in the stalemate position, and then this guy shows up. That's exactly what you're right.
Yeah, to review all the public issues that Walter was known for, all those things he was interested in. But Walter's looking at it from, he's a different person. If he had interviewed that guy, you know, 8 years before, it was a different Walter. This was a wounded Walter, and a shocked Walter, a happy Walter, as a result of his relationship with the woman, right? It's a different Walter.
Very much so, yeah.
So if we could hear the interview, knowing that, it would be interesting to hear what we can hear between the lines as he talks to this guy. Does he even bring in the personal thing that happened to him into this talking about MKUltra stuff or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So we know who has the tape. We know who has the tape, right?
Yes, we do.
And there's negotiations to get it.
There's been negotiations to get it because I was just asked I initiated trying to retrieve that, as you know, way back when, but I was just asked again because to initiate communication with his family regarding another issue as well as the tape, and that is, I might as well bring it up here, is that Walter and I inherited the Amalgamated Flying Saucer Club of America that was headed up by Gabriel Green. And we inherited all of that material toward the later stages of his life. And he was very, very much interested in all that stuff, as was I. And so we made effort to go get that stuff. And then just recently, I was asked to acquire that because of a special archivist that wanted to purchase that material for a special collection type of thing. So now there's two things that people are looking for. Whether or not we'll get them, who knows, but
right.
That just happened.
So, yeah, this other person got you going to get that UFO stuff, and you might as well get the tape while you're doing it, you're thinking.
Hopefully, yeah.
Right. Let's see. Ed, maybe you can come in with some questions. I mean, run the – there might be more to say about Soma. Did anything – I mean, I've got – you gave me the whole manuscript or something.
As far as it went was, and I wasn't putting hardly any effort into it because I knew he wasn't going to live that much longer anyway. And the amount of time it takes for a movie to even come out is usually 7 years, and he wasn't going to be around 7 years, so I knew nothing was going to happen. So I wasn't putting too much effort in it, but the American, big film school, we had set appointments up to see the heads of the department at that particular school, because we went to the particular school in Los Angeles. I forgot the name of it, but as far as it went, is he already had appointments to see the dean or the principal of the school, whoever's in charge of it, to tell him about Soma. Okay, so we're at the film school. Soma Corporation has already filed with the state of California. A real corporation, there's members now, the whole thing. I was director of public affairs, he was chief executive officer, and then the other woman involved was the one he was seeing. So we went to this particular school, we saw some presentations that they were doing there while we were at the school, and we were making contacts and so forth. Then at some point he got in touch with the people running the school, and he was trying to engage them to make a set up appointments. And apparently he did, and then right after that, then the whole thing died, basically, because something else got in the way that was more of a priority, and it never went beyond that.
Do you know what got in the way?
Yeah, him. He got in the way.
Right, but you don't want to go into the details.
Sorry. No, in his relationship was the priority. And also at that time, the relationship that he was in with her, her brother was dying of cancer as well. And she had to leave the country to bring him over to the United States. And it was that time that somebody with a similar disease came and lived in the house with them, so he got to see the whole process of that guy dying right in front of him.
And that was more interesting to him than the Soma at that point.
Absolutely, because he got to see the death process with somebody else with something similar, and all the whole thing that happens, and knew that's where he was headed, and he made a really strong bond with this particular gentleman that was going through it with him. So now he had a friend with him that was from a foreign country going through the same thing as him while they were both struggling with cancer. And that sidetracked everything.
Yeah, that was a new experience coming into his life, something new to investigate and study as a scientist, so to speak.
Right.
And as a shaman, what can he learn from this, right? He always went, whatever he got very involved with something, then he really went into it. Now, I have a thought here. Walter, you got the gig with the film school there because Walter was a great bullshitter. He could talk up what he was interested in and get anybody interested in it and realize it's important, right? He could get people's interest in what he was presenting about Soma. But the follow-through was hard. May not happen. But he was a great initiator of ideas, so to speak.
Yes, very much so.
And he always managed to inspire all kinds of people in institutions to take Walter, what he was suggesting, as valid or as worth looking into. But then his more and more, as his life went on, his personality got in the way, or his other issues of this personal satisfaction, yep, he was going for.
That's right.
So it was almost like he would do in the past decade of his life, well, once he came to California, he would go through his public persona on automatic pilot, just go through what he knew and do it when people were interested. But he wasn't really into that anymore. It was just an act, so to speak.
No, he used his door to open things, but he was kind of beyond all that. He wanted to go forward. He really wanted to go forward. He really wanted to be a screenwriter. He really wanted to do this thing with Soma, even though I think deep down he knew he would not live long enough to actually do anything with it. He really wanted to be a screenwriter.
But I'm saying once he met the doctor, all those things were not so predominant in his impulses
love
or what he wanted.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm thinking this title, Semiotics, Off-Screen Media Arts. I know that he became aware of postmodern studies through his daughter when she was at university in California or someplace. So he told me, you ever heard of Baudrillard? You ever heard of semiotics, which I knew about. And when I was in Toronto in the 80s and that, it was around the McLuhan Center, and I read the latest people on that. So Walter got into that, so he was able to learn the new, you could say, Generation X language of academia, you know what I mean? He brought this new word, semiotics, into it. And, I'm just thinking this idea of making healthy films, it really is a completion of, in the 50s, he'd be suspicious of the Vance Packard talking about subliminal advertising, so he'd know about that. And then he'd get into the political stuff, came out of the JFK assassination. Then he'd have his own experience with media, with each fill each other, and then he'd read McLuhan. That would be in there. And then he got into Sufism. And that he might have been into Sufism before he went to Puerto Rico. You know what I mean? He might have known about that stuff when he got to New York. I don't know. But he had that mystical bent, and then he's in Arizona, and he does it. He publishes these Sufi books and encourages seminars with that kind of content. Then he has a whole experience with Peggy, and then he creates Operation Mind Control, which is dealing with Vietnam again and the effects of that. Then he gets divorced, and then he goes and does a small town publishing, and then he goes to Palm Springs, that big scale publisher, right? Palm Springs Magazine. Then he drops out. Then the UFO abductee stuff happens, and he starts looking at that as an update of the Operation Mind Control stuff. And then he's also picking up on what was his term? What's the new DDS journal, the psychiatric thing? He used to talk a lot about that.
Oh, the DSM-4.
Yeah.
Problem with that. That's the kind of the official diagnostician's tool for psychiatry.
Right. Here's the thing, is that...
tearing that thing to pieces.
What?
He was constantly tearing it to pieces.
Yeah, when he visited us at the lab in New York in 94 with Pat, he started laying out all these levels, nomenclature of psychological states and relating it to the errors of that manual. So that was really the period he was into that. So that's why he engaged Colin Roth. It's like he was like president, and he was a benevolent dictator. Like, okay, what's going on over in psychiatric field? Okay, you produce a new manual. Look at, oh, you screwed up there. You need to do this. You need to do that. You know what I mean? he would constantly be managing society,
right.
Even though he had long gone off the radar. No one knew where he was. Of course, what he was studying, the life under the Android meme in the 80s and 90s, was not interested in that. Maybe more now, because it became a fad over the last few years for people to go to Peru and take ayahuasca, right? It's a fad,
right,
like yoga became. But what he was doing, you know, 20 years ago, nobody was interested. He was always looking. It's interesting. He's always looking at the fringe and see what new bizarre behavior would show up, like McLuhan. But always always looking at that and saying, okay, how can we take what we're learning from this fringe behavior, or what is this a new, what is the CIA doing now, and then bring it over to mainstream, which he thought that they would want to hear from him. You know what I mean? About what he's finding out from the fringe.
Right. Right.
He had no degrees. He didn't. Do you know if he finished university?
I believe so. Yeah. I'm not for sure on that though. If he did, I never heard about it. He never spoke about any of that.
Right. So he had created his own media identity, and as an author, and so he was this amateur engaging in everything. He was kind of like a modern Renaissance man, and looking at everything and thinking that people cared. And when he got to Hollywood, okay, now I can be part of the big message machine. And he found out they didn't care. And
so
then that's when...
No, he always got attention. But the problem was he didn't want to deal with all the crap that you have to do to get a film done and to get agents and all the protocols and meetings. He'd always make jokes about, oh, we're going to take coffee, we're going to take a meeting, take coffee, take a meeting, take coffee, take a meeting, because nothing would ever get done. He was just totally frustrated with all the nonsense that is Hollywood. That was
yeah.
the issue, because that's why he wanted me to go do all that, not him. He didn't want to. He wanted me to show up, make all the arrangements, and he just shows up the important stuff. But I had to do all the digging and everything else, the gopher work, so to speak, sometimes. So,
well, that's okay, James. That's an example of Quadrophenia. He's saying, okay, obviously my stuff's important. The public should know about it. And did he talk about the Bourne Identity and how that was a ripoff of his stuff? Those movies.
Yeah, well, he looked at it and he goes, "That's old."
Yeah, it's old stuff. But it was close to what he laid out once you saw all the movies
right. Back
in Operation Mind Control in the 70s. But it's like. He said, look, what I have to offer you, you should use, even to the extreme point of Soma. But before that, I've got a good movie here. You could educate the people. Here's a script. It's really good. Go make the movie. I've got to go back home and take calls from other people. My shaman duties are calling me. I got to go back and be a shaman one-on-one with people. You know what I mean? He's juggling his astral body expertise, his TV body expertise. And then also, not only do I have to talk about shame, to do some shaman stuff with some kids, I've also got to create a website for the New East Village Other, for the chip body. And meanwhile, I'm being harassed, and they might kill me any day now.
Right?
Exactly.
Very busy.
Yeah, that's right. Very busy, and so you were dealing with the TV landscape. And you, okay, James, you handle all that stuff. Just I'll come in and sign the dotted line when it's necessary.
Pretty much.
And then, in the middle of it, he finally had a meaningful personal relationship.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. He got all the good stuff at the very end.
And he couldn't get that. And so his whole life was an incredible, extreme form of frustration. And he really kept up a good front and was a really generous person that you wouldn't know that he was that frustrated.
That's right. Yep. I dealt with it constantly.
Yeah, you
I
saw it.
See it. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, Ed. There's a lot. The Soma thing, it's very interesting to take. Oh, yeah. When I got the full documentation of what you guys had gathered together for Soma, I think I got it after Walter passed on, I looked at it, and it was largely built on McLuhan's Tetrad. He was using all through that manuscript. He's talking and using McLuhan's Tetrad to support the argument of how he could make better subliminal seduction or something. So there's the McLuhan point. Did you notice that? Did you read the...
No, I knew. Yeah, I knew. We discussed the Tetrad multiple times, and he took notes on it all the time when we did it.
Yeah, and that's what we would... Well, we wouldn't talk about the Tetrad per se, but when we talked, and you have a couple of tape samples, it would be on another level. I would talk to him about, okay, McLuhan said this, but that's obsolete. What I'm doing, Walter, is what you got to understand, or what I'm seeing. That would be our conversation. You know what I mean?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
You two had a different report, because I remember you called in the later stages, probably 3 months prior before he died, 3 or 4 months, and you had a private conversation with him, and I watched when that was happening. He sat straight up in his chair.
Yeah, he was, quote, in class, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, and so it was funny when I saw the manuscript. He had all this old McLuhan stuff in there, and he knew that was way ahead for most people, so he knew he could sell that. Or, in other words, he didn't put what we talk about in there. It was like one, it was junior level of McLuhan information. But that was enough for people, and probably they wouldn't even get that about the tetrad. Because I would describe the pentad to him, how the Android meme is doing the tetrad management. But anyways, it just, you know, my point that he was influenced by McLuhan is right there in the final product.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact,
and
when I'll tell you how much it is, this is a interesting point that I haven't even mentioned. Well, no, you were there. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I mentioned it publicly that when he passed away, his girlfriend gave me three books that he wanted to make sure that I had. And those were all McLuhan books. City as Classroom, Counterblast, and
Take Today or Laws of Media? Or Cultures Are Business?
Laws of Media.
Right.
I think those three were given. So it wasn't anything that he wrote.
Yeah.
It was McLuhan who he left to be.
Yeah, it's very interesting that he was the last speaker on the sacred ground of the Center for Culture and Technology in Toronto, you know? And he was preparing people for the 80s, where actually the digital Android meme effect would create the popular interest in conspiracy. That was that whole popularization of conspiracy in the, you know, like the Art Bell level of Coast to Coast. It was a product that I predicted as a result of the digital shrinking of the analog media. You know, and so McLuhan, so we would be, if McLuhan was not in stroke conditions at that point, he could have seen that Walter was pointing to what was coming in 1980, 81, 82, 83, what he was presenting to the seminar there.
Mm-hmm. Very.
But I caught it, and I got it, and I ran with it. So the, let's end that, and let's have Ed. Okay, so we answered Ed's question. So 2 hours. Next question, Ed.
Well, James, could you describe the circumstances that led up to the to you and Walter acquiring the Amalgamated Flying Saucer Club?
He knew that I was aware of the location of where it was, because originally he got a phone call about that, and I remember I was out in the kitchen, and he told me that he was, at that time he was investigating, this was while I was in Santa Monica with him, we were deeply invested in investigating all the stuff that was going on in the UFO culture, and his phone was ringing, and we were comparing notes, and different people that we knew, and all that stuff, and he was interested in what I knew about George Van Tassel, because I used to live with his wife, and George Van Tassel was big during the Gabriel Green times with the Integratron is. So he got a phone call one day about, Gabriel Green passed away or something happened, or somebody had all that material, and he was going to go get it. I mean, I remember it happened very suddenly. He goes, "We got to go get this now, otherwise that's it. Somebody else is going to get it." And I remember him, he goes, "What are you doing right now?" And I'm like, well, I'm doing this. Well, do you want to go do this? And I said, "Okay, let's go. Where is it?" So we had to drive out almost to the Yucca Valley area, Joshua Tree National Monument area, where that stuff was, pick it all up and load it up. And we brought it all back, and it was just, he was extremely interested in all of the details of that, the notes that Gabriel Green took by hand of all the meetings that were happening Gabriel Green running for president, how influential the UFO culture was in that day on a high level. I mean, he had all the notes, and we saw just tons and tons and tons of paperwork and books and tapes and everything else. He forensically went through all of it, and that's when it was during that time that he became more and more interested in the alien issue. That was a big influence in his life anyway. His own
James, because he felt he had alien contact during the acid trip or drug trip of the late of 66, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Now, when is this Green guy? What decade are you talking about that he was going to run for president? Is this the Van Tassel period, the 50s or 60s?
Yeah, it's on. I'm sure I saw it on Wikipedia, but it references him running for political office at that time. And I remember seeing it because there were some of his campaign wear. For like, if people were going to campaign for him, like buttons and stickers and stuff like that.
Well, that's the 90s then.
Well, he ran for the Senate in 62. He got 171,000 votes. And in 1972, he ran for president.
Oh, okay, so this is a 60s guy. And so I thought you said you experienced it yourself. You saw the paraphernalia from his election campaign.
Yeah, paraphernalia, I saw it. Mm-hmm. Which was interesting because this was new. I wasn't familiar with Gabriel Green. And we went through all of that stuff, and it was during that time for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, he was interviewing people about it and talking to abduction cases and trying to hide his passion.
Whatever he got involved in, he'd become the journalist, or he'd get right involved for a few months on something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then he'd drop it, and then on something else would happen.
Well, he'd find out where all the action was, and then leave it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He'd figure it out, and he'd say, okay, these guys don't know as much as I do but that I got from my drug trip in 66. You know what I mean?
Well, no, he wouldn't think he was like an authority over it, but he was more like, you know, it didn't shock him or anything. He wasn't,
Yeah, because he had already experienced whatever anybody was going to, what new amazing thing, he'd already had it back in late 66.
Yeah.
No matter what it was, he had experienced it.
You know, I heard him talk about it over and over again, and what they took this advanced intelligence told him, which was like the key to the whole thing. And
yeah.
I remember saying that, you know, everything's perfect, Walter. It's perfect, and what that actually meant through all of experiences that, you know, you're the creator type of thing.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong, you're the creator, as we discussed with Ion and so forth. That was inside of him, and he was aware of that, yet, you know, everybody gets stuck in the blame game sooner or later, so he was going back and forth with that.
Right, and it's like he was, all his work after from 67 on was an investigation and looking for a validation of what he thought he had learned from the drug trip.
Yeah.
And he was saying, a new thing would come up. And he'd say, okay, tell me what the deal is. And he'd hear the deal, and he'd say, yeah, I know about that. That happened to the drug team. Oh, no, maybe I don't know about it. Tell me more about that. Oh, yeah, I know about that. That happened to me. You know what I mean? I think the McLuhan thing was the only thing that the drug trip maybe didn't tell him about.
Right. Yeah, most definitely. Because it was, I mean, no matter what... No matter if we'd get in a debate or not, or he'd get stuck, he'd always bring in the McLuhan angle because he knew I wouldn't understand that. Or he'd say, well, why don't you just call Bob? Call Bob. Call Bob. Call Bob.
Right. Yeah, to get to a level.
Why do I have to call Bob? Can't you just tell me?
Yeah. Well, you know, he couldn't say it exactly, but what he meant is, I'm on a level, James, that you're not seeing, he's saying about himself. I, Walter, in this dialogue, know more about what we're talking about than you realize. And to get you on the issues I'm thinking and questioning and wondering and doubting about, you're going to have to get debriefed by McLuhan, but best to do that through Bob. Then you'll get up to the level I'm on, meaning Walter's level, to see what I'm interested in.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. All of that was thrown out the window when he met his doctor friend.
Yeah, it wasn't a priority anymore.
Yeah. If someone suddenly called him up and offered to do a movie and say, hey, we like this Soma book, we're going to do it, he'd jump into it. Because that would help, that would give him some financial backing for his relationship with the doctor.
Yes.
But only for that reason. You're saying it's almost like he created Soma so he had something public to talk about, like, hey, this is what we're doing for the outer world, even though you and me is the most important part.
I think he did that for her. He did that for her because she really wanted to do something with him.
Yeah, change the world, carry on his great work.
Right. That's right.
Okay, Ed, let's go in. You said there might have been... What's interesting is these novels that he was writing. He always was writing about what was happening. He was always turning into a novel. So the novels are like a diary of all the things that he engaged, all the interesting new scenes, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So, maybe, Ed, yep. You might have a few questions about those fictional things that James saw.
James, you did see the novels?
Yeah, I saw the one of them that he was very much interested in was a screenplay or a story that he wrote called Shot by Beauty, which was about the use of gay battalions in the war and its effects on culture and media and all that stuff. That was one he was very much interested in seeing how people would react to that, but it never came to fruition. And then most
what was it called? Shot by a Beauty?
Shot by Beauty.
Oh, okay.
And the final one that was the most influential that he told me, this is just the last thing that he told me that he wanted me to make sure of his work that something happened to it, and that was a screenplay called The Other Crusades, which was about what really took place in the 60s, according to him. That was like the big one. I mean, he came back to that one all the time, but what really happened in the 60s and The Other Crusades needed many, many rewrites. I was like 35, 36 rewrites of that to get it exactly the way he wanted it. And I remember in my couple of last conversations, he goes, listen, I'll give you 20% of all the 20% of all the proceeds of Union. And I looked at him like, and I looked at him and I knew he wasn't going to make it to even finish it, let alone, you know, be around for the thing to go into production, even if it got picked up. So I was just listening to him talk, make sound, and I wasn't even, you know, I wasn't even talking because I knew it wasn't going to go anywhere. But that was his, one of his final wishes, is to have that made into a movie. The screenplay, The Other Crusades, which I do not have a copy of, and it may or may not exist on disc.
Yeah, and he was working on that in 91 when he came to Toronto and stayed at my place. So it's the other refers to the East Village Other. So he always was wondering, and again, really, The Other Crusades is about what happened to me on that drug. I was in the middle of a, you know, crusading as a journalist with this new alternative culture, and look at all that happened and unfolded since then. And he showed me in 91 a scene where he had me coming into Stanley's bar in 1962. So it was really about, it was his autobiography, trying to figure out all the dupes and cons and deceptions that were happening based on what he knew from the drug trip and the refinements that came in after and the new things. So it was like his diary novelized. And a lot of us, I mean, I'm pretty sure you would be in there, James.
Oh, yeah. Yep, I'm sure.
I don't know why he placed me back in Stanley's in 1962, because I didn't meet him until 1979. But in light of what we're learning from Ion, that might be accurate.
Exactly.
So, that... The Other Crusades, that is, I know that he's, I would say that would be worth reading, even if it ever got done, because that would be him commenting on what happened to Jerry Rubin, Leary, Abby Hoffman, and all the other movement figures, the right-wingers, the left-wingers, the anarchists. He was processing all that because, from my view, he was the most aware of all that period. He was like the authority. Okay, here's the final view of what happened over the last 40 years through the book,
yeah, that's right.
The Other Crusades,
right.
Or a movie or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty interesting, Ed, that he bequeathed to James 3 McLuhan books.
Yeah,
James,
we had talked nonstop about what I was going to do when he wasn't around. And he
did not foresee that it would be being on the radio with me.
No, but he made sure that I was in touch with Bob for sure.
Yeah,
that was.
We've talked to him through a medium. You don't want to identify this, James, I guess, but we talked to him through a medium. This is before Ion. And this was in 2008 when I got on the radio with James, and he was giving us advice. He was all for it. And he actually predicted Ion in a curious way. That's based on something, you know, that's pretty obscure, but he did do it. Just before it happened, the medium spoke to James, and James reported to me, and in retrospect, that was pretty interesting.
Okay, so how would you define mind control?
So I'll go first. I don't know. I'm still working on it.
Well, I would say I'm still working on it as well.
Yeah, now listen to this, Ed. This is what I'm thinking of as I say that. When Bob Marshall and I interviewed Zappa in 1988, Frank Zappa, who thought about all these things, had met Walter, been interviewed by Walter, thought Walter was CIA, which is interesting. You know, I just brought that up talking to Ed alone in the previous interview, but think of it now after we're talking. Zappa picked up a kind of detachment from Walter, probably, a kind of, oh, he's just pretending to be a hippie aspect, so maybe these are fake hippies and they're CIA. But what he was picking up is that was the observer, the scientist that was Walter Bowert. Whatever he was involved in, he was studying partly as a scientist and partly as a novelist, looking for material. Would you agree with that, James? That's what Zappa maybe picked up intuitively?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, he thought he was CIA, but he was picking up Walter's detachment. But in 1988, we asked Zappa, what did he mean by the famous song on his first album called Freak Out? 1966 it came out, okay, same time as Rai's Returning to the Plane of Essence, according to Cosmic Awareness. This album comes out, and he had a song called Who Are the Brain Police? So we asked Frank, who are the brain police? Here it is, 22 years later. What did you mean back then, or do you have a new definition of what? And he said, I'm still working on that. So my answer was quoting Frank. He's still working on who are the brain police, which is the right posture in light of what's happening to the quadraphenic android meme conditions we're in.
Most definitely. Definitely.
Okay, so let's see if Ion can throw some light on who are the brain police.